This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. We've got a bit of a youth theme going on this evening. I've been to Scotland to talk to a panel of young voters and been out on the campaign trail with the Prime Minister. More on that in a moment. But let me introduce my panel to you. They will be here with me through till 11 o'clock. Two former MPs hoping they will be back at Westminster after June the 8th. Labour's David Lammy and the Conservatives' James Cleverly. Welcome to you. Also joined by Mail on Sunday columnist Rachel Johnson, who, despite her family links with the Tories, has joined the Lib Dems at this election in order to campaign against a so-called hard Brexit and for a second referendum on the eventual Brexit deal. Have you had any grief?
private grief, Carolyn. It's I think, you know, I'm allowed to have my own separate opinions from my Tory MP, well, my Tory prospective MP brothers, I should say, and I think they accept that.
OK, well, personal views are allowed and that's what we encourage here. And Bob Kerslake, former head of the Home Civil Service, who now sits as a crossbench peer in the House of Lords. Bob, that cyber attack affecting the NHS is still dominating the news. We're hearing that it could have repercussions again tomorrow. With your experience within government, do you think there are concerns that government IT systems could be struck by a similar ransomware? And are there precautions against that?
Yes, I do. I suspect the defence and security systems are pretty well protected. But beyond that, I think pretty much every government department is at risk here. And the sums involved in protecting against cybercrime, cyber attacks, are pretty eye-watering. But I think we're going to have to look at that very seriously. And the key issue here is about investment, but also the discipline of the users of the system, because often these software malwares actually use users of the system against themselves.
Yeah, they do. The NHS was warned several times, wasn't it, about the system it was using. Are you convinced that the government systems, I mean, there must be so much intricate information and secretive information kept there. Could that be exposed by an attack like this?
I think there'll be some rapid checking now about how well this is handled, because I think up till now, really, cybercrime has been a matter of theory for everyday services. Now we know just the damage it can do. And it's not just the services that are actually immediately affected. I chair King's College Hospital. We have been on a major incident over the weekend because of the impact of what happened at the Royal London. So every bit of the system is put under strain when this happens.
OK, thanks very much for that. Well, now, prepare to be bombarded with policy details from all the parties this week. You may be crying for mercy by the end of the next 5 days. The main manifestos are expected to be unveiled. And tonight we wanted to put a particular focus on what young people, those under 25, are looking for. Now, as I mentioned, we'll be hearing from a panel of young voters in Scotland a little later. But first, the Prime Minister. I caught a few minutes with Theresa May during her tour of the North East on Friday, joining her on the newly launched battle bus. It's dubbed the Maymobile, the sides of it emblazoned with the words Theresa May for Britain, and the word Conservatives in tiny little letters on the door. No hiding the presidential nature of this campaign, then. Here's how our conversation went. Prime Minister, I've held a panel discussion with some under-25s for the Westminster Hour programme, and they were talking about their concerns about getting on the housing ladder, staying in employment, what Brexit might mean for their generation and for their futures. And these were youngsters in Scotland, where, of course, in all but general elections, the voting age has dropped to 16. Why are you showing no inclination to lowering the voting age to 16, or might you be minded to do that in future?
Well, this is one of those questions where you have to draw a line, you have to pick a point at which you think it's right for the voting age to be. I continue to think that it's right for it to be 18. Of course, we now expect young people more to stay in educational training up to the age of 18. And I think that is an appropriate point at which we allow people to have a vote in the parliamentary elections.
Even if it's different in Scotland, where they do have the opportunity to cast their vote to get engaged much earlier.
The implication from your question is that the only way to get engaged in politics is by casting a vote. Obviously, there is an engagement and an activity there, which is very much about people giving their view. And I'm very clear in this election that every single vote counts. But, of course, people can get engaged in politics in a whole variety of ways. And I would encourage young people to do so. I think it's important that young people, if you like, watch politics, pay attention to politics, get to think about their own views, and where possible, start to get involved. At, you know, there are lots of ways, youth parliaments, but also we see, you know, young people becoming councillors, you know, actually getting actively engaged.
But some people are saying, look, Labour have made a direct appeal to young people by saying that it would lower the voting age and scrap tuition fees. So you're not doing that. What specifically then otherwise are you offering to younger voters?
Well, overall, when young people look at this election, this is, I genuinely believe, the most crucial election that we've faced in my lifetime. The United Kingdom, our country, is at a key point of change. We need to get the Brexit negotiations right. We need to get the best deal for the UK from those Brexit negotiations.
And some of the youngsters I've spoken to really are concerned about their future and what's lying in store for them after those Brexit negotiations.
Well, we want a comprehensive free trade agreement with Europe. We want a deep and special partnership with the European Union. We're not leaving Europe. We are leaving the European Union. So we've got to get those negotiations right. And we've got to get them right for those young people's futures. And that's what this choice is about at the election. It is about the future of this country. It's about being able to take the opportunities that Brexit offers to change this country and make it truly a country that works for everyone. And if we look at more specific issues for young people, homes is a key issue for many young people. That's why we've already produced plans to increase house building, to continue to help young people as well, to being able to get on the housing ladder through the support of schemes like Help to Buy.
Of course, so charities will say that building houses is all very well, but there is a growing number, a distressing number of youngsters now sleeping rough on our streets. The changes to the housing benefit part of Universal Credit, which came in on the 1st of April, meant that 18 to 21-year-olds don't necessarily qualify for it. Are you distressed to see young people sleeping rough on our streets in 21st century Britain?
I don't think any of us want to see anybody sleeping rough on our streets. And that's why it's important, as we are looking at, we're putting £500 million over these 5 years into, you know, preventing homelessness. But it's important that we are able to take steps with some of the reasons why people become homeless in the first place. But actually, ensuring that we're giving young people support through schemes like Help to Buy, that we are seeing more homes being built, but more homes both to buy and to rent, that we see things like shared ownership, which often can be the thing that enables a young person just to get that first foot on a housing ladder. This is about young people's futures. Yeah. And I hope they will be enthused to see in me and my team a team that wants to build a better future for this country and has a plan and a vision to do it.
The Prime Minister referring to her new house building programme and her resistance to lowering the voting age. And I wonder, with our two politicians here, first of all, David Lammy, the Prime Minister saying, look, there are other ways to get young people engaged. You don't necessarily have to lower the voting age for that to happen. Would you agree?
No, I don't, actually. I think the voting age should be 16. I think if we are in a country that basically says you can have sex at 16, then you ought to be able to go into a polling station and enter a mark against the candidate and the set of policies that you agree with. So I certainly think we should lower the voting age. I am concerned about apathy. It's something that can affect and has affected generation after generation, and we've got to be vigilant about it. At the moment, though, I do agree with her. This is a crucial general election. We saw young people deeply affected by Brexit. I don't agree that the government are doing anything really on housing. We've got the lowest house building since the 1920s.
Although they say, of course, that Labour didn't do anything in their time in government as well, well in terms of to comparative
be fair,
numbers.
To be fair, the situation's got considerably worse since 2008. We're not building social homes or council homes, so the prospect of even having a home, I think, unless you've got Bank of Mum and Dad, is tremendously hard. And so across a range of fronts, whether it's tuition fees, which I think is hugely important to a group of young people who want to go to university, whether it's apprenticeships and being serious about those quality apprenticeships at a high level where you can get an income, whether it's stagnant wages. These are important issues for young people at this general
and
election.
And we'll be hearing later from some of the issues that the youngsters I spoke to in Scotland are concerned about. James Cleverly, what do you think about this? Because there are valid arguments for lowering the age to 16. It happens in Scotland for every election apart from a general election. Ruth Davidson, your leader there, has supported the idea of votes for 16-year-olds. Do you anticipate your party changing position on this?
Well, I certainly don't think it's going to change position on this. Was it 3 weeks out from a general election?
Well, you could have a manifesto pledge now for the election after that.
Yeah, but I don't think it's a good idea. As a society...
Personally, you don't?
No. As a society, we have collectively agreed that people are not fully matured at the age of 16. Now
they can get married, they can join the army,
but
they can't
go to war. They can join the army, they can't get sent to war. They cannot enter legally binding contracts. They cannot procure alcohol. So there are lots of things. And Scotland is different. So, for example, you know, we all know about the Gretna Green situation. So in Scotland, you're allowed to get married without parental consent at 16. You're not allowed to do that in the rest of the
UK. I don't know, Bob
Kerslake,
you know about the time when the introduction of the 16 votes in Scotland. I mean, what do you make of that argument?
Yes, well, it's hard to make an argument that Scottish young people are any more mature than they are in England. I mean, this is, I think, an absurd argument. Prime Minister's right, you have to draw a line. I just think it's in the wrong place. It should be 16. If you're old enough to work, if you're old enough to have consensual sex, then you should be old enough to vote. And it will come in time here. I do think the issues here go beyond the age of voting, though. We see, if you go back 25 years, something like 3/4 of 18 to 25-year-olds voted. And now it's nearer 40 to 45%. So we have a major issue, and it risks becoming self-perpetuating because they don't vote, they don't have influence. Because they don't think they have influence, they don't vote.
Rachel Johnson, the deadline for registering to vote is a week tomorrow, I think the 22nd. And I know that the Electoral Reform Society has said that things like individual voting registration, whereby each voter has to register themselves rather than being counted as part of a family or part of a university, that puts young people off. But can't you say that if somebody really wants to vote, that they'll go and register? Why do they need to be hiding behind an excuse like that?
Well, I mean, there are a range of different excuses, but I think a lot of people didn't register when there was some change to how your address was listed. Right. So students were in rented accommodation.
It's the individual
found themselves
individual registration.
Excluded from the electoral roll. And I'm glad that we seem to think that the voting age should be lowered to 16, because I think we're in danger of having government by the old for the old unless we actually lower it and bring the young much more into politics than they are. I was canvassing yesterday, and a couple of people sort of weren't registered. I told them they could register next week. They were very excited, and I'm also there was a Jeremy Paxman once proposed that, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to vote after the age of 65. And actually, what we saw in the referendum was the older you were, the more likely you were to. The young people. Yeah. But by and large, voted Remain. And so what the results of Brexit are going to be endured by the young people and the people who voted for Brexit are not going to have to suffer the consequences. Right, so I think that's all quite important.
Now, I chopped you off, James, cleverly, when you were chatting. And there is this point about the individual electoral registration. Since 2014, it's changed the way that you're registered. And a lot of people are saying that does disenfranchise youngsters because they're not counted in the way that they were.
No, but the point I was going to conclude is that we have, again, as a society, we've agreed that people under the age of 18 need to stay in full-time education or vocational education. And if you can vote at 16, you should be able to stand at 16. And if you're elected at 16, you're going to get day release from school, you get a message from your teacher saying you're allowed to become an MP. So the point is, I can understand if we want to look again completely, including things like the age at which you can take out a mortgage and that kind of stuff. If we're saying those should all be at 16, let's have that discussion. But the idea of picking voting as this one item out of what is a basket of entitlements, I think is wrong.
Quick word from you, David.
Just the elephant in the room. We know that many who are elderly and older, they get a triple lock pension, winter fuel allowance, all sorts of benefits and freebies. Many of them vote Conservative. We know that the real reason why the government are not going to change their mind is because 16-year-olds have a propensity to be a slightly more progressive and liberal in their outlook. And for those reasons, it will remain the same until we get a Labour government.
I think a quick look at my research suggested that Austria is the only EU country where the voting age is 16. So we may not be alone in having 18-year-old voting. Anyway, we move on. Ben Reilly-Smith, Assistant Political Editor at The Telegraph, joins us now. And before we look at today's policy announcements and look ahead to the manifesto launches, I just wonder what have been the standout moments for you this past week of campaigning?
Well, it had to be the Labour manifesto leak. I mean, I think that will be remembered as the standout moment of the entire campaign as well as this week. It's staggering to have a whole party's plan for government put in the public around a week before they hoped for it. One really interesting point, I thought, is that it is clearly the manifesto Jeremy Corbyn wanted. Huge swathes of left-wing policies in there, chunks of the energy sector, nationalise, cap on rents, cap on wages for companies with public sector contracts. And some critics in his party are quite happy about that, because if he owns the manifesto, then he'll have to own the result in their eyes, which does look like a defeat if the polls are right.
So that was a standout moment for you. Anything else?
Well, as you mentioned, the revelation of Theresa May's battle bus, not the Tories' battle bus, this huge signature and name of Theresa May, it just shows how the entire Tory campaign is being pinned on her. And I think that's for two reasons. One, obviously, she is outpolling her party. She's more popular than the Tories. And secondly, the Tories want to constantly focus on leadership because they think that is where, when voters say May or Corbyn, they will go for May.
So they are going for personalities. Tell us briefly about some of the announcements that have come out today.
Yeah, Labour have gone on tax, the Robin Hood tax they've announced, which is basically a tax on financial transactions. Without wishing to go into the weeds, it's a 0.5% tax on the sale of bonds and derivatives. Gets $26 billion over 5 years. And obviously the Tories have attacked it as a raid on the city. But they're very confident because they're saying, listen, it's only on big business, big finance, and we're happy to defend it.
You're happy with that sort of policy, David Lammy?
I think it's fantastic. My God, we've needed this kind of transaction tax for ages. If you're making
Sadiq
investments,
Khan,
you're
I don't
taxed,
think is quite so happy well, with it. He doesn't like it for the city, does he?
Sadiq will want to speak up for the city, but Labour looking nationally absolutely should do. It's a lot of money. It's money that's needed. It's very, very small. And in fact, it's on derivatives and actually gambling effectively on the stock market. So Europe's looking at it. Other countries. Hillary Clinton was trying to push it in her campaign. It's absolutely something we should lead on. And it's the same people who say we shouldn't have the minimum wage now saying, oh, business is going to leave. Absolute nonsense.
All right, well,
ordinary
look,
folk need this.
Sounds like you need to talk to Sadiq Khan, your mayor. Ben, Tory announcement today. What did they announce?
Yes, they went on housing, and in particular social housing. There's been this big problem, as Theresa May sees it, of a decline in council housing over the last 10, 20, 30 years. She's proposing a series of rule tweaks to try and encourage councils to get building on brownfield land. But it has been criticised today because there's not a huge pot of cash that's going to fund this measure. It's more rule changes.
No new money, James Cleverly. I mean, that's a problem, isn't it?
Well, no, the new money was announced in the spring budget. £1.4 billion is a lot of money, and the money is part of it, but also actually changing some of the rules so that it is easier for local councils and housing associations to compulsorily purchase derelict properties and derelict land, so that it frees up the big chunks of land, often in brownfield areas, that is not being built on at the moment. So the combination of the rules tweaks and the money will unlock a step change in our ability to build affordable housing for the people that that were being discussed, the homeless people and others across the country.
And we were discussing earlier that successive governments have admitted that they failed to build houses. Bob Kerslake, it must have been an issue that has come up time and time again. Why have so few ministers been able to grasp this one? And do you think this attempt by the Conservatives might work?
Well, it's probably the biggest single policy failure since the Second World War, in my view. And many have tried, and so far the impact has been limited. We desperately need more houses in this country, and particularly more affordable. And to get there, we need to have every player on the pitch, public, private, the whole lot, which is why I welcome the move towards social housing. If you look at the press release, though, it's worryingly numbers free. There's nothing about the date, the numbers, and how much it's going to cost. And I think if we're serious about tackling this problem, there has to be a real commitment to numbers and how it, and when it's going to be delivered.
What do you think, Rachel?
Well, I mean, I think it sounds like a manifesto pledge that probably won't be met. And I think we were saying earlier that we're going to see some quite red-tinted ideas in the manifesto next week on the social housing. We've had the energy cap story, workers on boards, and, you know, it's a land grab for the Labour seats, in which I'm sure she will be very successful, but the proof will be in the pudding. You know, in 5 years' time, are we going to see an expansion in our housing stock? Probably not.
Well, Ben Riley-Smith, we are going to get the manifestos this week, and there are these questions about will this manifesto define Mayism? Mm. Will it be far too interventionist and away from free market policy, the kind of thing that some Conservatives are warning against but others are embracing? I mean, what are you hearing about the Conservative manifesto?
Well, it's really fascinating. When Theresa May became Prime Minister almost a year ago now, almost nothing was known about her economic agenda. She'd been in the Home Office for 6 years. We'd had that really short campaign because Andrew Leadsom pulled out. So she was suddenly running the country without this huge spelled-out ideology for what she wanted to do in the economy. Ministers and cabinet ministers have been surprised by actually how interventionist she's been over the last 10 months, as Rachel was hinting at. Mm. I think we'll probably see more of that. The big question is whether Tories who instinctively are frustrated with that move are actually going to speak out. My sense is not, A, because they don't want to lose votes, and B, what a lot of people are saying behind the scenes is, if she delivers on Brexit, I don't really mind about the other stuff.
Well, James Cleverly, I mean, how detailed do you think this manifesto should be? I mean, the more detail, the less it can be challenged in the House of Lords, I suppose. But on the other hand, is it better to be broad brush? You don't want to get into the same sort of problems as you got into over national insurance and the change that you had to do on that a few months ago.
I'm full disclosure, I'm speculating a bit because I've not got any particular insight into...
You mean you're not in the room?
I'm not
in
the room.
With Ben Gummer?
I'm in the room with you,
Timothy,
but not with Ben and Nick Timothy and those kind of guys. So this is what I suspect will be the case. I suspect there will be a number of detailed policies in the manifesto. But I also think, because the whole Brexit process means that we need to be agile and fleet of foot and adaptable, that the manifesto team won't want to tie us down too much. They won't want to limit our future freedom of movement. What I think we will see is some pretty explicit commitments to principles, to ideas, to political philosophy. Because ultimately, whilst the precise route is not possible to define here and now, ultimately, what the British people want to know is, who's at the steering wheel? Who do I trust to navigate the future?
So we're getting back to that presidential idea again. Are you happy with that?
Because ultimately, what this boils down to is, who is going to be best at adapting to the circumstances as they are presented. And it is a clear choice. There can only be two people credibly in number 10 after the election. One is Theresa May, one is Jeremy Corbyn, and people will be presented with that choice.
You're forgetting about Tim Farron. Now, Rachel Johnson. Tim Farron has said, to his credit, I think the most important thing for a leader is clarity. Clarity, number one, is to be honest with you and everybody else. We all know it's the truth that the Prime Minister is heading for a colossal coronation on the 8th of June, referring to Theresa May. So he's kindly ruling himself out of the options. However, for the Lib Dem manifesto, I mean, there will be lots of policies, won't there? But the position on Brexit is the overriding thing for the Lib Dems. And that is the reason why you've join the party.
Yes, I mean,
I'd like
to make it clear that, you know, I joined the Lib Dems for that reason only, for this election, maybe only, because I think it is a historic and important election, especially for Theresa May, because it's going to reconfirm her as Prime Minister. That's why she keeps saying, what a historic election it is. You know, yes, it is for you, Mrs. May. The Liberal Democrat Party and the SNP and the Greens, but I'm afraid we have to. They are even less likely to make it into Downing Street than Lib Dems in the next 100 years. Are the only ones who are offering the people a second choice, a second look at whatever deal eventuates. It could be no deal, and I'm interested to hear from the two perspectives here whether you think it's enough that Theresa May is only offering a, I don't know what kind of vote in Parliament, whatever the deal she manages to produce. Are you going to rubber stamp any deal in Parliament? If it's just going to be a rubber stamp, then I do think it's very important that the country is allowed to have another look at the deal, because this is going to affect generations to come.
Come on then, chaps. I mean, David Lammer, you voted against Article 50 being triggered, but when it comes to that point when, and Theresa May has said that there will be a vote in Parliament before the end of the negotiations, what will you do if there isn't a deal?
Look, I've been absolutely clear. I think there absolutely is a case for a second referendum and the country looking again at the actual deal that's made. I'm very worried about bleating on about sovereignty as the leavers have done, and then quietly doing a deal behind closed doors and not even genuinely bringing it back to our parliament to decide.
But Ben Murray-Smith, it's true, isn't it, that Jeremy Corbyn has said that there will not be a second referendum on the EU?
They have, but there's been a bit of confusion about what a meaningful vote means at the end. Keir Starmer, as he mapped it out, a meaningful vote means if Parliament says no to the deal, you go back to the negotiating table and then you discuss it. But what happens
but
if...
No second referendum under Labour.
Yes, that is their position. But, you know, when Jeremy was questioned about it 4, 5, 6 times, he didn't say, yes, we will undeniably be leaving the EU if I am Prime Minister. So there is a lack of clarity that possibly the Tories and Lib Dems don't have.
So, James Cleverly, what about you? Answer Rachel's question then. What would you do? I mean, if there is no deal, are you happy with this idea that no deal is better than a bad deal?
Yeah, absolutely, because a bad deal is a bad deal. And if we sign up to it, that's what we're stuck with. So a no deal can only ever be a temporary position, because ultimately, if we can't come to an agreement at the end of the formal Article 50 process, we will do what most countries around the world do. We will keep talking, we will keep pushing for that comprehensive free trade agreement. And if we can't get one straight away, we will keep plugging away until we do get one, which is in the interests of the UK.
God help us.
And in the interests of the EU. Because the alternative, let's look at the alternative. The alternative is, you know, a bad deal is something we've come back and say, this is a deal that is not in the interest of the United Kingdom. I'm not sure that, you know, David and Rachel and others would say, oh no, we should definitely sign up to that deal, even though it is explicitly and obviously not in the UK interest to do so. That is a ridiculous situation.
Of course, Lake.
Yeah, it's hard to see any outcome from this process that doesn't leave our economy weaker and our country less influential. The question is how much, and how much are we prepared to put up within this deal? I think we'll end up with a pretty unsatisfactory deal, and that will be what we'll end up having to agree to in the end.
Ben, let's come back to you on the manifesto announcements, because we hear from Labour that it will be Tuesday of this week. Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, was on the Andrew Marr programme this morning, encouraging people to think about the policies on offer rather than focusing on the individuals.
actually we're talking to the public. We're giving them answers to their day-to-day problems. You know, and people need to look at the at what choice they have. You know, not Theresa May's hair, not whether or not Jeremy Corbyn should shave or anything like that. Is about which politicians can offer you what. What is the two different futures right. that Britain has? And the Labour one is a much more positive one and is much more in line with what people want.
So Labour's leaked manifesto, do you think that's pretty much what we're going to see next week on Tuesday when the manifesto is launched?
Well, I think we might be seeing some new policies in the next couple of days. Interestingly, there were some gaps about tax and they filled it with the Robin Hood tax today. Tomorrow, we're expecting a big push on NHS and a huge announcement on spending. £37 billion will be put into the NHS if Labour win office over the five-year Parliament. They also say they're going to take 1 million people off NHS waiting times by the end. How is that paid for? Well, corporation tax and income tax rises for the 5%. It's good area for Labour to be talking about if the polls are to be believed, because that is their strongest policy area. They're far closer to the Tories on health than, say, defence and security.
But just as Theresa May has been accused or it's been pointed out that she's taking policies from Ed Miliband, you know, the energy cap, so Jeremy Corbyn seems to be following Ed Miliband's tracks. So what did Ed Miliband do that everybody is adopting his policies? Was he a great thinker that we weren't recognising at the time, David Lammy, or what's going on?
I wouldn't say he was that, no. what I would say he did was he did actually have a comprehensive process. He put John Cruddas in charge. Mm. He had think tanks like IPPR doing a lot of work. There was actually a lot of policy developed. We didn't always deploy it in the right way and at the right time. And so it does mean that, in a sense, whilst this election's been a quick one, we have been able to arrive at both some of that policy, but also more traditional socialist and left-wing ideas that's time have come in order to actually have, I think, a really firm choice for this country, particularly in relation to investment in public services.
But you know you will be scrutinised, and we keep hearing time and time again this will be fully costed, and credibility on economic management is the key issue for Labour, isn't it? John McDonnell has been saying that as well. And every single dot and comma of this manifesto from Labour is going to be scrutinised.
Absolutely. Rebecca Long-Bailey, our Treasury spokesman, was on television this morning on the BBC. She did a fantastic job as a relatively new entrance into the political scene. So,
next leader?
I'm not suggesting, I'm not getting in. The next leader is Jeremy Corbyn.
Until
but
when?
She did a very effective
when,
job.
So, David?
So
until June the 9th? Or,
well, I've been in this game 17 years, so I do recognise that names are bandied about. But I'm merely saying that the scrutiny, of course, will be there. But anyone on the left has got to know that in relation to tax and spending particularly. And you've got to be prepared.
OK, so, Ben, we will let you go and do the papers. So we're thinking Labour launch on Tuesday, Tories possibly Thursday.
Tories probably Thursday, Lib Dems possibly Wednesday. And the Tories have a big workers' rights announcement tomorrow, which is interesting, a whole package of measures for workers' rights that fits into this whole narrative. So we may see that on the papers, let's see.
And, of course, we've got all the other parties that will be following their manifestos as well. We'll have the SNP, presumably, I think, maybe towards the end of this week. And, of course, when it comes to the party offers in Scotland, it's pretty clear that the questions of independence and Brexit remain the most important dividing line. We do hear predictions of Labour's failing fortunes in Scotland. Will they be wiped out completely? We hear about polls showing the Conservatives are resurgent in Scotland. And, of course, for the SNP, another landslide victory of the sort it won in 2015, getting 56 out of 59 Westminster seats, would bolster its push for a second independence referendum. One of the most notable aspects of the 2014 Scottish referendum was its extension of the vote to 16 and 17-year-olds. More recently, under-18s in Scotland were also able to vote in the Scottish Parliament and local council elections. But as we heard from the Prime Minister earlier, dropping the voting age for the UK-wide general election is unlikely to feature in this week's Tory manifesto. So what's the mood in Scotland among millennials as June the 8th approaches? What are the issues that most affect them? Here are some insights from four younger voters who joined me for a chat this week in Glasgow.
I'm Gregor Ironside. I'm 19 years old and a university student in Stirling.
Hi, I'm Natalie Curran. I'm 19 years old and I'm studying in York.
Hi, I'm Christopher Barber. I'm 22 years old and I'm currently a university student at Strathclyde.
I'm Stuart Doran, I'm 20 years old and I'm a student at Glasgow Caledonian University.
Well, thank you all for joining me here, and it's my chance and our listeners' chance to catch up with you and find out a little bit about what you want from this general election and what your hopes and fears are for the future. And I guess my first question to each of you is, what do you think of the general election campaign so far? I'm going to start with you, Gregor.
Personally, and I suppose rather selfishly, I'm just really excited to be able to vote at a general election. But so far, I've really been enjoying it. It's been great.
Have you come to a decision about which way to vote?
Yes, I'm absolutely going to be voting Conservative.
All right. And Natalie, a month too young for the 2015 election, so here's your chance. Now, how do you view the campaign so far?
The honest answer is I don't know an awful lot about it because, being a university student, I'm too busy worrying about exams. I'm still very much weighing things up and also see how it plays out a bit as well. Because I think if you set your heart too quickly, sometimes you don't listen to anything else afterwards.
Stuart, what about your views of the campaign so far?
I'm quite split, annoyed really about this campaign. I don't think it was needed in the first place. But I'm certainly going to be more open-minded to what this election will bring, because I think it's going to be a totally different general election than what the last one 2 years will be. We've never had this opportunity at a general election at one time, but Brexit negotiations going on at another, could be another independence referendum within the next year and a half. We've just had council elections. It's a very difficult time, but a very exciting time for people to get involved in politics.
Christopher, at the grand old age of 22.
Yes, I feel like an elder statesman of elections now, so...
But do you think that it's running along the lines that you'd like?
I think there is an interesting contrast emerging between parties. I think some of the parties are pursuing a sort of tightly controlled presidential-type campaign, and others are moving back towards the more traditional style of campaigning, the holding the open rallies, the public meetings. And we haven't really seen that in my lifetime anyway, and I'm sure most of us on the panel.
Do you like the focus on personalities and individuals, or would you prefer it to be a party-based campaign? Because inevitably, the personalities are intervening. Jeremy Corbyn versus Theresa May, Nicola Sturgeon versus Ruth Davidson.
But I'm not actually opposed to, you know, personalities playing our own election campaigns, but I do fear that we're moving towards an American-style system. Yes. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, I think elections should be about policies, not personalities.
Well, what are the key issues, do you think? Natalie, you were saying that you've got time now to absorb, to think a little bit about it. What are the issues that you would like to see addressed?
Each time elections come round, there's obviously the key topics about employment, education, health. I don't necessarily, on the base of it, have an issue with what the government does or doesn't spend. What I have an issue with is their prioritisation. And sometimes I just like that a bit clearer, and too often it feels like it's empty promises, which I think is partly why I don't follow these campaigns that rigidly, because I don't believe half of what they come out with.
Gregor, what are the issues that really matter to you? Are you worried about the impact of Brexit on you and your generation?
Yes and no, I suppose. I voted Leave. To me, I still really don't take that much of an interest in the whole Brexit issue, Brexit process, I suppose. It's just not as engaging and it's not as important to me as Scotland remaining part of the UK, first and foremost. That is what I care about more so than Brexit. But yeah, I think it is going to be important that we secure a good deal for the UK in order to make sure that it's good for future generations as well. Yeah,
Stuart, you voted Leave, but now you're regretting it.
Much to the surprisement of everyone on the panel, yeah, I can see their faces. Yes, I did. As soon as I walked out the polling station, and I literally mean as soon as I walked out the polling station, I thought, well, what have I done? That was the wrong... It was a completely wrong thing to do. If I knew now what I knew then, I would completely changed my vote and I would completely stay in.
What's affected you? What's changed you since?
Oh, yeah, I voted to leave the EU because I felt the whole system around it was people who were unelected. That was why I voted to leave. Now, thinking about it, I felt that we should be staying in to try and reform it, not walking away and hope somebody else does it for us.
Christopher, as a Labour supporter, what's your view about Brexit? Do you have concerns about what it means for your generation?
Well, like Stuart, this might surprise the panel, but I also voted to leave the European Union. And on broadly similar grounds, it was mainly to do with the European Union's treatment of Greece in 2015 that turned me away from supporting the EU towards voting to leave, ultimately. But on the wider issue of Brexit, I think it actually poses quite a distinct economic threat to young people in particular. I fear, for example, the loss of research funding to universities, the loss of participation in programmes such as Erasmus.
But you voted leave.
Yes, I voted leave, but I was hoping and support a more softer form of Brexit where we retain more of the economic benefits that come with European Union membership. I think fundamentally people voted in a referendum and the result has to be respected. I think, more importantly, I think it's the outcome of the negotiations that matter now to me.
Well, Natalie, given that you have some concerns, what do you think about the argument that some are making that there should be either a second referendum or at least a chance for you, the voters, to have a say on the final deal? What do you think?
Well, I feel like we voted Brexit. I may not like it, but we have to go with it. And because if they turned around and said we're going to do another referendum, in the case of the Scottish one, I'd be just as angry as I am. You know?
And just to clarify, when in the last independence referendum you voted to stay within the UK?
Yeah, I'm very much friends together, so Scotland and England together and the UK and the EU together.
Christopher and Stuart, when it came to the independence referendum, obviously Stuart, SNP position, it was leave the UK.
Yeah.
And Christopher, Labour supporter, you wanted to stay within the UK. What's your view then on another referendum? Do you think that there should be another independence referendum, Christopher?
I don't think there should be, and I don't think there's any evidence at all that people in Scotland want a second referendum. And my worry about the way that Scottish politics has gone over the past couple of years is that the constitutional question has taken over the actual issues that matter to young people. So we don't talk about, for example, the rise of insecure employment like zero-hour contracts. We don't talk about the housing crisis, you know, the worsening educational attainment in Scotland. These issues aren't discussed.
Stuart.
Nicola Sturgeon went to Scottish people. She put that if the Scottish people had voted for the SNP and the numbers that they did, and they did do, that that would secure a mandate for another referendum. Saying that, it should only be called and it should only be announced when the public support it. It certainly shouldn't be called, as Nicola Sturgeon quite clearly said, by her, by Theresa May. But no, it should certainly be called when the people see that the opportunities are right.
Now, I said I wanted to ask you where you got your news from. And, I mean, I'm assuming that social media, mostly Facebook, Twitter, whatever, is the way you're getting it. How much is it influencing you? And is that the case, Natalie?
Guilty as charged. Yes, I do get a lot from things like Facebook, but I do also check where it's come from. And I never base my views on just one thing. I look at different stories, I'll talk to other people, hear different opinions, different views. Just try and vary it, because no matter what you read or listen to, it's going to be biased.
Gregor?
Stuff that I see on Facebook and Twitter, I just treat as more entertainment than actual news.
Stuart and Christopher, Stuart first.
I would get a lot of my news from just different eclectic balances of kind of like newspapers or media outlets, Facebook and social media. I think as Gregor was saying, it shouldn't really be treated, unless it comes from a reputable source, it shouldn't really be treated as kind of newsworthy facts. You should actually look deeper into it and see where it comes from.
Christopher?
Well, my mum is an avid news watcher. She'll be pleased I said that in the radio. So I predominantly get my news from the TV news channels like the BBC and Sky. And I've also started getting my news from newspaper online sites. My fear about social media as a news source is obviously the threat of the echo chamber, that a lot of people just read what they want to read or see what they want to see. And so I always try to do what Natalie was saying and balance my sources.
I've got friends who are really interested in politics and therefore look a lot into it. I've then got friends at university who are maybe not that interested, but they're not that daft either. They're not going to believe everything they read.
Just because you're not politically motivated doesn't mean you can't read through the lines and actually see what the news story is for yourself.
I don't want to sort of make this conversation seem pessimistic. I mean, I'd like to be optimistic. But I wonder if you could just outline to me how you view the future. And again, I'm just going to go around and ask each of you. So, Gregor, given that there is a lot of change and turmoil at the moment, how do you view the future?
Overall, I would say I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic about Brexit, I'm optimistic about Scotland remaining in the UK, and I'm optimistic about the general election and what Theresa May is going to do for the country. So I would definitely say I'm optimistic about the future, for sure.
Natalie, you strike me as a very optimistic person.
The thing is, the future does make me nervous, and Brexit, I think, is going to happen. I'm a bit anxious about the way negotiations have been going so far. I'm nervous about another Scottish referendum. So because I'm nervous about all these things and can't do anything about them, I bounce along in a happy bubble until they wait for it to happen. You know, there's nothing I can do other than vote and hope for the best.
Christopher?
I actually feel quite uncertain about the future. My worries are about, will I be able to get onto the housing market? Will I be able to rent my own home? Will I actually have some form of secure employment?
Stuart?
Bleak, Carlin. Just disastrous. We're entering a point in politics in the UK right now with utter confusion and chaos. We have two mainstream parties, one with the Prime Minister who was voted to remain, leading negotiations and a conversation about a right-wing hard Brexit. That fills me with deep uncertainty, not a lot of promise there. We have an opposition leader who hasn't got a clue what he's doing, saying that I love Jeremy Corbyn. I absolutely love the man. I love his principles and his values, but a leader, oh, he's terrible. And that gives me fear because we don't have real opposition. Unless we're independent, no, I feel that the UK right now is entering a bleak time of disastrousness.
I'm going to address the last question to Natalie, as you're the only undecided. Are you veering one way or the other, having heard your friends, your colleagues here talking about it?
I think, to be honest with you, I'm probably more towards Labour, but I want to see a bit more definite promises. They like looking at the Labour policies, they all seem a wee bit utopian. And also, I'd love to believe them all. Show me how it's going to work. Show me you can follow through on it. And then you'll have my support.
We've got all the manifestos coming out. You lucky people. You've got lots and lots of information to pour through. I'm going to draw it to a close there. Thank you very much indeed. Natalie Curran, Gregor Thanks. Ironside, Stuart Doran and Christopher Barber.
Thank you.
Cheers.
And it's back to us old fogies speaking personally. Thank you very much for that panel. And we've got the papers in and Ben Riley-Smith has come back. And they all seem to have the same headline, which is announcing a sort of bidding war for working class voters. You've got Jeremy Corbyn promising to take 1 million patients off NHS waiting lists by 2020. And the Prime Minister unveiling what she claims is the biggest extension of workers' rights by any Conservative government. Give us a sense of what she's saying.
That's right. It's a package of about 10 different moves. I'm not going to run through all of them, but a couple of them are. One, this issue of workers on boards comes up again. She's not saying every company has to put a worker on their board, but what they will have to do is pick from three different options. One is to consult with a panel of workers. Another is to have a non-executive director kind of representing workers. So trying to boost the representation of workers on boards. That would be a real talker, I think. Then there's some really interesting policies about leave. One, she's looking at a policy in Ireland and say we might bring it in here, which is leave for carers. So if a family member suddenly becomes very ill and you need to go and be a full-time carer, you can have the right in law to leave, care for them for even more than a year possibly, and then come back to your old job. And then one more is bereavement leave, which is if you suffer this horrific loss of a child, you will have the legal right to take time off, which you don't currently.
And James Cleverly, that's something one of your colleagues campaigned hard on, wasn't it?
Yeah, Will Quince, who's the MP for Colchester, who lost a baby, unfortunately, he's been doing some fantastic work on this. A lot of cross-party support, to be fair. I'm really, really pleased to see this. And I think with this kind of range of packages, what we're seeing is the Prime Minister recognising that a lot of British people have said that they feel insecure in the working environment. She's listened to that and she's choosing to deal with that.
Rachel, workers given a legal right to take a year's leave from their job to care for elderly relatives?
I'm afraid the thought that occurs to me on this is a very good way of addressing the social care funding crisis, because it doesn't cost the government anything to have a worker unpaid looking after an elderly relative for a year.
David Lemmy?
The key is it's unpaid, is the truth. This is dressed up to get Northern Labour voters. Look at the detail. There's not much in it, really.
I'd like to see the detail, but overall, I think this bit of policy pinching moves in the right direction. You've got to contrast it with the trade union bill we had last year. Right. This is very different territory for the Conservatives.
Got to end it there. Thanks to all my guests, Rachel Johnson, Bob Kersley, David Lammy, James Cleverly and Ben Reilly-Smith. We're back same time next week. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.